Hi, I'm Rose Solari of Allen Squire Publishing, and I'm happy to say that I've got Reuben Jackson in the studio with me today. Reuben Jackson is a poet, a jazz scholar, currently the archivist of the Felix E. Grant Collection at UDC, formerly the archivist of the Duke Ellington Collection at the Smithsonian. Reuben's hosted many jazz programs on the radio, and today we're going to be talking about jazz, ballet, poetry, his life, and an exciting new project coming from Allen Squire Publishing and Reuben. Reuben, thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here. Good to see you.
You too. I'd like to start talking about D.C. We're both Washington, D.C. natives, and it's something that we've spoken about many times before.
Right.
I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about your childhood influences and how you came to poetry.
Sure. I always tell students and, well, even people like at the barbershop or wherever, that the first poets I heard were ministers, people on the AM radio with that rapid banter, and like just guys on the corner or in the barbershop who could take a word or two or three words and turn them into this musical, like etudes almost. And I was fascinated by the sound of it and what it could convey. So, I mean, it's like three really powerful examples of like the possibility in language. But the radio, you know, I was the kid who would take the old transistor radio and keep it under the pillow at night for the music, yes, but also just to hear the differences in the way various programmers would, you know, approach things.
Oh.
So it's like, boy, they're telling you things, and there's a sound to it. And there's a sound, you know, when you just pronounce a word or words, and you think, boy, it's just like playing the piano or playing the clarinet. You know, like an adjective could be a B flat or something like that. But I loved, what's that old movie? Like, it's like The Sound of Music. And it's, yeah, so it's another kind of music.
So you were always aware of the musical qualities of language.
Oh, yes, yeah. And my parents were always talking at the dinner table. And just the difference in their approach. You know, my mother was more like, if you think of like the Miles Davis, John Coltrane recordings, you know, my mom was John Coltrane because she talked a lot. And so if you think of the sound of John Coltrane's tenor and those rolling, urgent arpeggios, and then by comparison, my father, whom I called a walking haiku, would give you like four words every 6 months, like, Rose, that's a nice blouse. That would be July. And then in November, he might say, getting cold, you know? But just even that, so different approaches and the sounds, again, you know, getting like the timbre and all that, which obviously ties into music, but again, it's like spoken
right.
music.
Now, your mom was a school teacher, right?
Yes, she taught. She's a language arts specialist.
Oh.
Taught sixth grade. And, of course, now I can see that at best I'm like a variation on a theme because her love for poetry, her love for music, she was a big anchor for me. And I sort of understood it when I was living it. But, of course, you know, it's like the thing about distance and what you understand about that relationship and about myself, because to use the old cliche, I think I'm becoming more like my mom every day, and which is nice because she's not here. But yeah, so she was a school teacher. My father was an engineer at Pepco, and more, he was the pragmatist, and my mom was a little more of a dreamer. And, you know, my father was kind of like, you're not majoring in English because you're not coming back home to live when you graduate. And my mom was kind of like, he'll be okay. So I needed, and I, you know, I got things from him also, but the big stuff, the big heart stuff is like my mom really allowed me to talk about it because it's tough when you love things. There's loving things, and then there's just the degree to which something just kisses you, and you just go, what do I do about this? I'm so immersed, I can't stand it. But she allowed me to talk about, again, whether it's music or language, and I'm profoundly indebted to her.
What was the first art form that you practiced yourself? Did you write a poem before you played music, or did you play music first, or can you remember?
It was music. You know, I can't remember a time when I didn't, say, know how to read music or try to write it, you know, and I didn't always understand, you know, certain things, properties with particular keys, but I would... my brother played clarinet for many years, and he had like score paper around the house. I would try and write things. Sometimes the note values were off, but I would try and write stuff, and I'd give it to him and say, "Could you play this?" And you know, bless his heart, he would play it, even though you know, like I have so three sharps. So that's A major, but the note quality is probably more kind of atonal. I'll be nice to myself and say that, but. He would play them, but I was all, I think music, you know, certainly to be redundant, like the sound of it and what it did, it really, I've said this a million times, but it tapped me on the shoulder and said, let's go. Wow. And there's like, so there's the enjoyment of it. And I don't know, whichever side of the brain, the nerd side, which is like, how does this work? What is this? And because my mom was a really good classical pianist, modest about it. We'd listen to stuff on the radio or on the stereo, and I'd say, "What is that?" And she'd say, "Oh, those are passing tones or what have you." So it gave me some sense of what something was, or what you called it, what the compositional device was,
right,
and its function. But so yeah, music, certainly music.
And what instruments were you playing as a kid? Or were you always more interested in writing the music itself?
I started back, maybe they still do this now, I don't know, but DC public schools, you could choose an instrument, or if you want to get like Neruda, say like it chose you, or Rilke, whoever. And fourth grade, my brother had gotten a new clarinet, so there was a hand-me-down clarinet. So my first instrument was clarinet.
Okay.
I wanted to play violin, and I told the band teacher, "I want to play violin," and she said, "Men don't play the violin." And I went home and told my mother this.
What?
And my mother took off school the next day and went to my elementary school to meet with my band teacher. And she said, "Don't ever tell my son this." She says, "You never heard of, you know, like Isaac Stern or any of these people."
Yeah.
But it was that, I think it was like the, what, like gender stereotype. But anyway, I ended up playing clarinet. And my brother and I, sometimes we did duets in church. We would try to play along with like Motown tunes, because as you know, Motown arrangements were laden with clarinets.
Yeah.
Ha ha ha. No, they weren't. But so we didn't get the polka band together we were going to do. It's like the funk polka band. I'm being facetious here now. But
so then when did poetry happen? Can you remember when you first wrote a poem or tried to?
I'm sure this must have happened before 10th grade, but my 10th grade homeroom teacher, I went to Western High School, which is now Duke Ellington School for the Arts. And my 10th grade homeroom teacher was editor of the school newspaper. And one Friday she came to me and said, "We need a poem for the next issue. Bring one in Monday."
Whoa.
So I said, "Well, who are your favorite poets?" I thought she meant go to the library and get like a, I don't know, Sarah Teasdale or whomever. And she says, "No, I want you to write it." Why? She asked me, I don't know, you know. And I thought, this is trouble. So I went home and tried to write the worst, most mawkish poem I could, which in high school is not so hard anyway, because I think the mawkishness is like cream rising to the top. But I wrote a poem about a woman who sat in front of me, and this is dating myself, typing class, but she had one of those perfect Roberta Flack, Angela Davis afros.
Yeah.
So the poem was called, dare I say this for the record, Ode to the Sister with the Most Perfect Afro. So it was really, and I said, "I'm going to mess this up and she'll leave me the heck alone." So Monday, I go and Ms. Milbury, I said, "Here's the poem." I think like she'll parole me here. She says, "Oh, this is great. You're a staff poet. I need a poem every month." And I thought, I messed up somehow. But, you know, I became... Well, I grew to like it, you know. I'd go to the library, and I didn't really know what I was doing, but I would go to the Georgetown Library and get, well, the 811, that's the Dewey Decimal Number for poetry. I would just sort of knock everything off the shelf and check it out, so I'd have, like, you know, Keats and Don Lee or some, or you know, Haki Madhubuti or whomever. But I'm reading all these people, like, how do they do this? And I would try and imitate people. I take words out of the thesaurus and say, okay, today, try to put these four in a poem. And that really kind of got me rolling informally. And then my 11th grade homeroom teacher, who was a gym teacher, knew I wrote poems. So I would slip her stuff and she'd write notes and say, oh, you know, this is really interesting, or this reminds me of whomever. Have you? So that's really how I got started. I don't know, can I say seriously, but that's when the snow started to stick, I would say. Grade school up until then, I can't say I never tried to write anything, but it was like the music, you know. As I always say, I've been chasing music my whole life. And then, I mean, being a poet is chasing music too.
Yeah. I wonder, it sounds like you had so many good teachers, and mm-hmm. I wonder what role being born in D.C. and raised in D.C. played in all that. Was your experience of the city growing up one where you were getting fed and nurtured by teachers and by other adults, or was it more complex?
Oh, my gosh. You hear this cliche a lot when people of a certain chronological vintage talk about growing up, whether it's here or Detroit or wherever. But it's true that in our community, you know, I had, well, my birth parents, but also people who would discipline you or would teach you and or raise you. So it's like the broader community, the people I kind of knew, like, again, you go to barbershop or there was church. So there was a lot of that. And they protected me, too. I mean, it was even the guys who, and I don't really like this term, but like old school thugs, mm-hmm. people would call them. And they knew more about me than I probably knew about myself. And, you know, this a little later, but when I was like in middle school, well, was junior high then, and I'd go to a party and somebody would approach me and say, I heard you were at this party, 7th and Ingraham last Saturday. And I'd say, yeah, because I was trying to fit in. They said, you know, if I hear about you going to a party there again, I will blank, 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 you know, expletive. You can't, this is not for you. And of course, broke my heart because I thought, I'm never going to have a country. But they were part of it too. So it started early on. And I think being here at a time when so many, and you know, my case, African-Americans had come from further south and things were still really like overtly segregated. So I saw teachers and electricians and bankers and, you know, bakers and hustlers. I mean, you saw a wide swath of humanity. And I think I keep going back to that. You know, people ask me a lot about, oh, you write a lot about being young, but those were the foundations. And it's not, I don't see it as nostalgia, but it's trying to understand and revisit where, as people used to say back in the day, like where you're coming from. Mm-hmm. And I think poems in a way are like, I can't build a monument on the mall for these people. But the poems, in a way, are like the monument or a plaque with someone's name. Like, here's where I tried to kiss Brenda Jones and she laughed at me, or whatever it is, you know. But it was profound, and I'm still learning from them. You know, many of these people are not here physically, but it sounds corny, I keep them with me. Every day I think about that kind of rich grounding and what it is doing, has done and is doing to help sustain me and you know, keep going.
Yeah, I mean, that's a kind of richness, I think.
Oh, my goodness.
It's like having money in the bank when you have that kind of path.
It could be challenging, too, because we were expected, like my late brother was 8 years older, but we were also expected to move the race forward.
Right.
So that's a lot when you're a kid, because you understand that as best you can at a certain point, but you're also watching Mighty Mouse on TV. And a comedian who I can't remember who said this once said, he said, first I was a child and then I was black. And I remember that funny juncture when it wasn't even either or, but you, you got Mighty Mouse or whatever's on TV, and then you also on TV are people sicking dogs on black people. So what do you do with that? You know, all this stuff is starting to, like, close in the washer. You know, they're, like, spinning in the agitator.
Right.
And you think, what? This isn't going to go away. Just like the things you love are not going to go away.
Well, I remember you talking about, I believe it was on another radio program, you talking about your father telling you very early on how to deal with the police.
Oh, sure,
and
yeah.
And how to protect yourself.
The talk, as they call it now. And see, again, my father was terse. So he would say, like, if I was going to a corner store, I'd say, I'm going to the store to get, like, a soda. And he'd say, get a bag and a receipt. He'd say, well, I'm just getting the soda. And he'd say, get a bag and a receipt. It was like a mantra. And right. he was telling me, you know, so they won't think you're stealing it, get a bag and a receipt. And the same thing with the police. If you're stopped by the police, this is when people also thought or hoped that, you know, good English would help you. So make sure your subject verb agreements are okay, an officer, all that kind of thing. And it's necessary, and it's a lot for a child. I mean, you know, you're carrying, you need red caps for all these bags you're carrying. But it was, as I said, it was necessary, and I appreciate it. But, you know, in addition to my father just being a man of few words, I think it was too painful for him to articulate it even more.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and he was kind of the guy who would tell my mother stuff, and my mother would say, your father says this, and she, of course, would be more expansive. And I would ask him about it just out of curiosity, and he'd look the other way. He didn't want to talk about it. So I have no idea. I think there are probably just deep wells of you know, sadness and anger that, gosh, I have to pass this on to another, not just another generation, but it's your son.
Right.
Yeah.
So there were probably experiences that he had had.
Oh, sure.
In stores and with police officers that he didn't want to share with you.
He was born in Alabama.
Wow.
And then I think for him, this, of course, is kind of related, but I've been talking a lot about the fact that, you know, you have parents who were born in the Jim Crow South, particularly where my father's concerned, and then your son ends up maybe in places that he didn't anticipate. I don't mean bad places, but how do you make sense of those things? And he still had the same fears, which obviously impacted him as a younger person, and he would still talk to me about them. And then I remember seeing them at the Folger when the Columbia Book Award ceremony took place, and he was proud, but I think he was a little, what did they say, gobsmacked, like, how did I get here? And I wish he would have talked more. I wish I had asked more about those things.
I think it's always the case that when you get closer to the age your parents were, especially when they had you, that you start wondering about those things and wishing you would ask more questions.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah, it's true. It's so true. And for everything you do know, there are, of course, a zillion things you don't. And maybe that's also where poetry comes in. And you can, I always tell students, well, it's like you can play in the sandbox and you can delve into the questions. And it's not that you're fabricating stuff, but maybe even the questions form the basis of something you want to write. But the older I get, the more I miss my parents. And I think this drives some people crazy. It's like, well, just get on with your life. But I think I understand them more now, and I see where the influences live in me. And that's not the only thing I would like to talk about, but just to hang out with them. And it's difficult to not have a nuclear family when you get to a point and you feel maybe better about yourself, and you just want to sit on the porch and drink lemonade and you know, even talk about a bad call in a football game, whatever it is.
So I'm talking to Reuben Jackson about poetry and some of the decisions that he made as he became a practicing poet. Reuben, I'm curious. I know that in the era when you chose graduate school, there were MFA programs available. And I know you were already writing poetry, but you chose to go to grad school for library science. How did that all shake out?
I think that I was always trying to live my life and please my parents and or kind of placate them. And I thought, well, okay, this has to do with, library science had to do with books. I'm chronically bookish. And it turned out okay, but that was really it. I wanted to be a writer.
I didn't really know
what that meant even in my early 20s before I graduated from Goddard, a small college in central Vermont. One of my professors pulled me aside and said, you know, I could see you doing all these things with writing. I could see you teaching and lecturing and stuff. And I thought, I can't do that.
And did you major in English at Goddard?
Yes. Yes. And that, see, again, my mom plays into this because my father was worried about getting a job. And she said, because in 11th grade, I was kind of, certainly no pun intended, on the road with writing. And she says, well, we have a year. I'll work on him, my father. But yeah, that was a decision, kind of a compromise thing in my head. And I think I've been lucky as a writer, considering I was multitasking, you know, before they called it that even then. So it's like your life, my life, and then like, okay, mom and dad, you're okay with this. You know, it's a lot.
Sure.
Yeah.
And then that was your concentration in library science in music? Is that how that, I'm not really sure how that degree works.
Right. Yeah. Well, you can go, it was library media studies.
Okay.
And I did my student teaching when I was an undergrad and was certified, you know, teach like high school English, which I backed away from initially in part because, you know, love for my mom notwithstanding. It's like if your mom's Aretha Franklin and you love singing, you still might back away from it. And I was,
yes,
you know, so love aside, I said, I'm not going to be like my mother and do that stuff. And so I was kind of filibustering too, I think, you know, but I had like the education. So I did a practicum at Cardoza High School and I didn't know how this was going to play out, of course, you know, in your later life, you know, and in the meantime, I'm trying to write villanelles and stuff. But so it's like, you know, you go to work, you get a quote, good job.
Right.
And then at night you go to places like DC Space or wherever, you hang out with your writer friends. So I don't know, like a double life maybe in a way. I've thought about this a lot recently though, you know, and what it cost. And I don't mean in some tragic way, but it was a lot. I guess maybe I think about it because as you get older, doing three and four things at once becomes, how you say, challenging.
Well, and I think for a lot of artists, you know, the need, unless you're fortunate enough to have family money, mm-hmm. you've got to have some day job to put food on the table. Poetry's
right.
not going to do it,
yeah.
you know. Playing music wouldn't necessarily
right.
do it.
Right.
So I think for a lot of us, of those of us who grew up working class or middle class
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and are artists, there is a sense of a double life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, you're spending a lot of time during the day doing something that may not be the closest thing to your heart.
Right, right.
Though you were fortunate enough to then become the Duke Ellington curator at the Smithsonian, which must have been an extraordinarily wonderful way to put food on the table and a roof over your head.
Gosh, yeah. I still shake my head over that one. A friend who worked Smithsonian Library this was back when job announcement for hard copy.
Right.
So she sent this thing to me and said, this job would be perfect for you. I knew she would nudge me if I didn't apply for it. And I looked at it and thought, no way in Hades, but I'll apply for it so she won't call me every other day and say, did you apply for this job? Did you apply for this job? And I did. And I remember saying to her, yeah, this will be like, you know, getting a date with Halle Berry or something. Like, it's not going to happen. But, I mean, sure enough, you know, I got an interview and ended up being hired. I was there for 20 years. I think in retrospect, you don't want to, I don't know, I don't want to necessarily rank things, but it's like the job of a lifetime. And you can't, I've never been able to, younger people ask me about career choices and they say, was this part of your 5-year plan or what have you? And I said, you know, nothing like that has ever been scripted in a sense. It's been like someone maybe seeing something in you that you didn't see in yourself. Like the
right.
Jane Miller, the poet at Goddard, who said these things about me. And I just thought, no. And, you know, my friend who sent the job application saw something I didn't want to acknowledge or didn't see. So I was fortunate in that. And still, you know, the people who see and believe things about you that maybe you kind of know it, but you haven't really fully embrace them, or as my yoga instructor would say, you haven't really inhabited that incarnation yet, you know.
Oh, yeah. That's a beautiful thought. Yeah. Talk about Ellington specifically, if you would. What Duke Ellington in particular has meant to you. I remember you doing extraordinary work in that job and really kind of expanding the definition of what jazz could be. I remember you lecturing on Jimi Hendrix at the Library of Congress showing me a whole new side of that. But to get back to Ellington for a minute, what is it about him that keeps his work close to your heart?
I would say the possibility, you know, if Patti Smith has that phrase, the sea of possibilities, and he's someone who, if you're just thinking, quote, in a way, kind of technically, so there's like the popular song, the 32-bar song form, extended works. He wrote ballets, operas. He was the kind of guy who could be backstage with like a do-rag or, you know, Yiddish, a shmati on his head, and he's like got a cigarette and he's playing like the funkiest blues, or he'd come up with these incredible chord voicings that you just couldn't imagine. And he was what people used to call a race man in terms of his pride and love for being African-American, but not in like a hackneyed way. He was garrulous, very private, quite the ladies' man. Understanding what he did, his persistence, he was a radical in ways people still don't quite understand. I mean, he quietly led an all-black band for 50 years, and he just did it. So I think there's that part of it. And just the invention. I mean, I was subbing for somebody on WPFW, the Pacifica station here, does a lot of jazz. I played some blues pieces, and I said, who did more with this form than Duke Ellington? How do you, you know, it's kind of like one of those basics of music, or with poetry, you think like the sonnet or something.
Mm-hmm.
Who could, like Ezra Pound said, who could make it new like this? And you just listen to it and think, whoa. You know, he kept going to the well and coming up with this material. So there's like that, his understanding of working with individuals who were often very difficult personalities. You know, that band often had like kleptomaniacs and just curmudgeons, people with substance abuse problems. And even those who couldn't stand him because he'd take song ideas and make the money. But they acknowledged that he was able to get the best out of them, and that he would write parts that weren't just standard issue parts. They were, one of the musicians said, they were vistas, and you look forward to that, and I think, whoa. So, I mean, it's like all those things, and, you know, when you're with someone's material for 20 years, people sometimes ask, and they still ask, well, you know everything about Duke Ellington, don't you? And I maintain, like, the more I was around and with that material, the less I knew.
That makes sense to
me, yeah. Because he loved humanity, and he was very private. You know, he'd smile and talk to you, but he had like a gentle, stiff arm. He kept the world at bay. And I think what he created was probably hard on his son, Mercer, but I think that was his child. That much I can say. But he was incomparable. I mean, yeah, that's often like an overused adjective, but yeah, he was.
Something else that strikes me about your relationship to not just jazz, but to many art forms, it occurs to me you love opera.
Oh, goodness, yeah.
You love ballet.
Yes.
You love jazz, which is really America's classical music form. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. These are all classical forms. And yet, your poetry, I think, is very modern. Hmm. In the way, especially the way you use punctuation. I mean, Fingering mm-hmm. the Keys has no capitalization, right. No punctuation.
Right.
You play now with punctuation, with your periods, and mm-hmm. in interesting mm-hmm. ways that are very modernist. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm curious about this. It's not exactly a contradiction, but you seem to be fed and informed by classical mm-hmm. sources, and yet you're a modern romanticist, it seems to me, in your poetry. Does any of that make sense to you? Is there any part of that you can unpack for me?
It makes perfect sense. I think as far as the forms you mentioned, I guess the simple thing I'd say is, you know, you love what you love. And mm-hmm. but I am, if we just take music, for example, well, quote jazz, and talking about that, I would also talk about like the relationship between jazz and what was for many people like the classic era, the American popular song, like Jerome Kern and people like that. Mm-hmm. The structure and again the possibility in those, a lot of those pieces, just I mean it touches me emotionally and like the sort of nerd methodology side. And I probably in my heart of hearts I am like an old 32 bar love song. But yeah, I guess the expression is another, it's another thing. But it's informed by, again, what is possible. I think the courage that many of these composers had, and you know, courage alone doesn't necessarily make something, to quote Duke Ellington, worthy of the plateau, but I think it helps. And it's always fed me, you know, like you mentioned ballet and opera. Like I fell in love with ballet when I was in second grade. And
How did that come about?
My student teacher, Mrs. Curitan, was a dancer. And she gave our class tickets to see her at Swan Lake at the Jewish Community Center on 16th Street in D.C. So we went, I got tickets for, you know, my parents took me, of course, and I'm just sitting there, and this thing is just, and I just said, look at the grace and the invention in this. And my heart felt just light and calm and excited at the same time. And, you know, it's like you meet somebody and it happens, and you're trying to be calm, but you know, this voice is saying, you love this. And I knew, like, I knew that it had me. And I would talk to her whenever I could about dance. And she would tell me about people, you know, well, have you heard of this person? And of course I hadn't. I didn't know, like Raven Wilkinson was this African-American dancer who was in the Ballet Russe and was like an innovator and like a big kind of pilot light for a lot of African-American dancers. And I didn't know who that was, but it was important to me. Or, Arthur Mitchell at that time hadn't started the Dance Theater of Harlem, but just these names and, you know, the great Russian ballerinas. And I just thought, this is incredible. So I felt this door open. And I'd go to the library, the Tacoma Park branch of DC Public, and the adult librarian would let me take books out. He'd let me come in the adult room, which they weren't supposed to do.
Oh.
I mean, I don't think they'd like sick dogs on you if you went in or whatever. But and I would take home books about ballet, but I would stick them under like Madeline in Paris, which I also loved anyway. And I would go home, and it kind of freaked my father out because we're sitting at the dinner table, and you'd say, pass the mashed potatoes, and say, oh, you know, I learned something about the Kirov today. And I think he was kind of like, this is my son, you know, because, you know, my father kind of hard scrabble, his father, my grandfather was a sharecropper, you know, it's a different lane of the highway. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it hit me in opera, like third grade, we had enrichment teachers come in and Mr. Jacobs would come like twice a week and he played something from Rigoletto and I thought, and he explained that, he said, don't forget about the stories, because people think opera is this thing which is like cannot be understood. And I said, oh, you know, and I tell people that today, but the orchestrations, the vocals, everything was just like, I don't know. I'm running around. I have all this stuff in my head. And I also have people in my neighborhood, like this guy, Butch, he was cool, really beautiful looking man. And he could say MF, like a, that was a ballet. You know, so you got like, you know, I always say like I'm from Monet and from MF. So you have these things in your head, but to be, you know, specific, the influence of those things is, I think the heart is what comes through in, or I try to put into the writing. And lately, I think I'm a bit more forthright about it. One of, you know, you look at older pieces or like Fingering the Keys, and I said this recently, that there are poems which stop at a joke, which maybe came off pretty well, but I wanted to go a little bit beyond that. So like you're out with someone, again, to use a date metaphor, and you're smitten, but you're like trying to act, yeah, like you're cool. But, you know, your knees are just weak. You're it's taken over. I think I'm more, again, to be a little redundant, forthright about it. And I think it comes from, well, again, to be, to say this, what can be done and what one has to say or one attempts to say as a writer. And it also just sustains me. I mean, the writing notwithstanding, if I hear like John Coltrane playing, what's that song by Harry? It's Easy to Remember. It's like the tenderness and the sincerity. And you just think, well, I think of that and I think, how could a man stand flat-footed in a studio with an instrument and play? It's like he's, the woman's up on a, like a trellis, above a trellis, and he's walking down the street and he sees her and he just says, I just feel this about you. But it's for everybody. And I just think, wow. I've hidden this part of my personality for so long. And I think translating it, it comes from these forms, having seen it. And it's like in your heart. And then you come home and like a friend says, oh, you went to, your mom took you to see Dance Theater Harlem. How was that? And I say, it's all right. Like that. But, you know, your heart is just, I couldn't sleep. I'm tossing and turning. And the question I always ask myself, Ruben, what are you going to do with all this stuff in your head? And hyper curious. And you know, my parents fed this. My mother, again, maybe more so. So, I mean, this is, it sounds circuitous, but it really isn't. I'm really trying to explain how they, the forms impact me. And right now, I would say more emotionally, though I do like musicians who sit down and play fugues and that kind of thing. I do practice, if you want to use that term, with form at home. You know, like I love Sistinas and those things. And maybe the next courageous step will be to put some of those out in the world, as they say.
I'd like to ask you about putting things out in the world. Your first book, Fingering the Keys, came out in 1990. The great late Joseph Brodsky picked it for the Columbia Book Awards. That was kind of an astonishingly brilliant debut. But everything you've published since has been in magazines, whether in print or online.
Right.
Now we're getting close to the time to announce that you'll be doing a new one selected with Alan Squire Publishing next year. But that's a long gap between books.
True.
And I'm sure you could have had many publishers interested in another volume. Was there any strategy involved in having such a great, brilliant meteor of a first book and then not pursuing another one?
Boy, I could lie and say, yes, it's part of my 10-year plan. No, but I would be
for
lying.
Your 30-year plan.
Yeah, my 30-year, right. Yeah. I'll wait until my hair falls out and then I'll put on. I was like the kid who maybe, like you throw a rock through the window and then you run. And I was not, What did Tennessee Williams had this essay, like, The Catastrophe of Success? Yes. And you're thankful that people care. I didn't really know that this book was going to have, and I feel extremely blessed that it still has resonance with a lot of people. But you have to somehow be able to handle this. And I was afraid, like, that maybe something coming on the heels of it would not be as well received. Hmm. I asked myself if I could do it. And I don't think I really owned my life fully at that point, you know. And now I do feel more, you know, present in every aspect. I had no idea, you know, that this was going to happen. So I freaked out. I mean, I would say I freaked out. It's like you crave the attention, because I was the kid in the back of the class who knew all the state capitals and state flowers and stuff. And suddenly people want to see you. You know, they put you on a reading and say, oh, no, they put me last again. I'm nervous. And people would say, well, you're the headliner. And I go, I can't be the headliner. But I'm also, like Miles Davis said, you know, I have a certain amount of ham in me. So I loved it, but I was scared. And so that's really what happened. And then life happens, like my, you know, this book came out, and then next year I won like the Mayor's Arts Award for Outstanding mm-hmm. Emerging Artist.
I remember that.
The year after that, my father died, which was probably the first big heartbreak in my life. And I kept writing as best I could. I was writing for jazz magazines and stuff, but it's tough. Yeah, I'm one of the things I also note in looking at Fingering the Keys is I can hear and feel, even though I wasn't a youth in the sense of being 11 or 12, there's still a lingering sense of being younger in this piece, in this book, which ended after, you know, like one event doesn't seal a chapter per se, but I think things changed profoundly for me after, like, my father died, and then, you know, my mom was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and life happens, and you still write as best you can, and but I think it's like fear and then life. So but I, you know, coming back home, coming back to DC after having been in Vermont for 7 years, and people, younger writers approaching me and talking about Fingering the Keys and what I meant and mean to them, is just, it's not about ego. It's like, my gosh, how could you? I kind of missed it in a way, you know, because I was skittish. I was skittish. And I'm more, well, like the analogy I use with John Coltrane, you kind of just stand flat foot and sing, or to be pejorative, you know, like, not pejorative, but colloquial, sang. You just sing your song. So yeah, it's been a process. And now I think it's, I'm owning everything as best I can. And I want to, share some more things.
So I'm talking with poet and jazz scholar Reuben Jackson today, and one of the obvious questions, maybe too obvious, is what do you see as the relationship between jazz and poetry?
Oh, goodness. Yeah, that's like...
Do you find that jazz feeds your poetry, or your poetry feeds how you hear jazz?
Let's see. The relationship between jazz and poetry. Musicality, first and foremost. And something Joseph Brodsky said, those remarks, you know, about Fingering the Keys was something he, and I'm paraphrasing him poorly, but he kind of compared them to solos, you know, instrumentalists. And that was deliberate. You know, I look at transcriptions of Clifford Brown solos and stuff, and I would think, okay, well, the theme is inherent within the poem, but how do you want to solo or kind of improvise on these themes, which I guess we do anyway, even if it's a more structured form, you know, mm-hmm. Like you could compare, say, like the blues form to, and I'll use Sestinas again, just as an example. So there's that, but also going back to what we talked about at like the outset, the sound of music, you know, the sound of language, that is also, I think, a big commonality, you know, because like I was, one night I was on the train, Red Line, coming home from a reading, and there's like some, I don't know if they were start trouble, some young guys came in the car, it was just me, and I thought, I started reciting Dylan Thomas's, especially when the October winds, like, you know, especially when the October wind with whatever, the frosty fingers punishes my hair, caught by the crabbing sun, I walk on fire and cast a shadow crab across the land. Well, A, so it's iambic pentameter, but I'm listening to the sound of it. So if it, whether it's Dylan Thomas or Clifford Brown playing trumpet or, you know, Miles or Shirley Horn, honoring the content of the word or the note and what you, Rose, or whomever brings to it, not just in terms of your story, but to sing. And I think that's one thing hip-hop has returned to, really like universal consciousness, is the singing and the stories, but internal rhyme, those kinds of things. I often say that like, disco made it safe for me to talk about obscure composers when a lot of these groups in the 70s were redoing, and not obscure, but Cole Porter and people, names like Victor Schertzinger, which I thought I'd never in life be able to say in public. And I'd say, oh, Tangerine was written by Victor Schertzinger. And they go, oh, Ruben, it's like your 2 minutes of hipness. But so with poetry, the internal rhyme, you know, and how that impacted, which is another story, my after-school work as a poetry instructor with students who knew more about poetic structure than they probably realized because of this. So structure,
because of the music they listened to?
Yeah. And I said, well, you know what rhyme couplets are. You haven't heard that term before. So in a way, that's no different than my mom telling me, well, you understand how parallel fifths work with music. You just didn't know what they were called.
Right.
So musicality, structure, I mean, there are a lot of technical things I don't want to, you know, but like rhyme and meter and all those sorts of things. But for me, it's what Quincy Jones called jazz, soul, and science. And I think that might sum it up perfectly for both.
That's beautiful.
Because it's, you know, I might be in some beautiful sunset might walk in front of me and I'm trying to write about it, but that's a start. It's not enough. So where does the science come in? And then it's like that old TV commercial, like knowing when to say when. All the decisions that writers make with musicians, like, well, what key am I going to put this in? How am I going to orchestrate it? Well, you know, poets, we're orchestrators. And I used to consider these things pains in the behind, but now it's, boy, there's so many options. And if one thing doesn't work, you know, like maybe Coltrane might have tried My Favorite Things in 4/4 time, and he thought, no, keep it as a waltz. So there's that. And it goes back to the off-sited, in this interview, the possibility thing, you know, what is possible? Or a student once said to me, remember that old song by Kool and the Gang, Hollywood Swingin'? I said, yeah. He said, the first line is, hey, 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 what you got to say? And that's it, too. Like, what do you have to say? You know, what do you have to say about Allen Ginsberg, or you know, if it's Ode to a Grecian Urn or to a Skylark, which I'm breaking my own heart here. Anyway.
To talk about possibility, to continue with that theme for a minute, I know when you were at the Smithsonian, as I mentioned earlier, I saw you lecture on Jimi Hendrix.
Mm-hmm.
I know that when you had your NPR jazz show in Vermont, mm-hmm. You would play Earth, Wind, and Fire. Mm-hmm. I believe you got some flack for that from time to time for people saying this isn't really jazz. So to get to this idea of possibility, it seems that to me that you see jazz in a much broader way than a lot of people. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, say, why someone who's the curator of the Duke Ellington collection would also be lecturing on Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah. Oh man, that's a great question. The silly answer is like I said. Oh, my mom dropped me on my head when I was two, and but you know, going back to foundations, just mm-hmm. you know, thinking like musicians and poets, we heard a lot of music at home. You know, my parents listened to a lot of music, and back then they had those record clubs where you could, I don't know, you get like 3 or 4 albums a month. I forget.
Right. Yeah.
So you know, the shipment would come and. Like Muddy Waters and Rachmaninoff and South Pacific and, you know, Andy Williams. So I didn't know that people made these. I mean, you like something or you don't like it, but I didn't know that people separated music the way they did. But to be specific about this jazz question, one thing which has always interested me is like cross-pollination is what I call it. And the influence of, you take a band like Earth, Wind & Fire, like Maurice White, who founded the group, was a jazz drummer with Ramsey Lewis, a session drummer. A lot of those musicians were trained in many disciplines, among them the, quote, jazz tradition. And it's like, well, how does the continuum manifest itself? Is it just, is it only jazz if you just play Stella by Starlight? Or where else does it go?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not to refute one, you know, one side of things. The other example I've often used is, because like my father loved different things, but he and his friends would go to the old Bohemian caverns in D.C. and hear like Cannonball Adderley and people like that. And I said, well, these are people who thought the Fender electric bass was like Satan's project, sink the Western world. So it's like, well, they put you in a room, figuratively speaking, with, okay, one record player has Count Basie, and the other one has, like, the Shirelles. And they have a gun, and they point it at you, and they say, pick one. And, of course, the answer from someone like myself would be, well, what if you love both? And I think for some people, music, like with poetry, is like that. You know, they'll say, well, you can't love the Shirelles, the you know, great vocal group, and Count Basie. But you can. And I think I upset people. I wasn't trying to be provocative. I was really looking at, you know, like if the tradition is a river, you have tributaries, and mm-hmm. where does this go? There's a beautiful song Bonnie Raitt did called Ain't Gonna Let You Break My Heart Again, and Herbie Hancock plays piano. Well, isn't that great? You know, it's like people from supposed different neighborhoods playing. So, I mean, there's that, and it's just this broad way of looking at things, which I do again attribute in great part to the home environment, and same thing for poetry. I mean, you either like something or you don't, but you know, as a workshop instructor, you have people who are kind of like with the Constitution, they're strict constructionists, and they say if it's not form, it's not poetry, and then you've got somebody who loves, you know, like beat poetry. And I said, well, this is good. You know, it's good to argue about it in a way because we're not making any money. Let's just see. But they're all part of this big thing. Yeah, I guess what you're saying is true, that I see or hear it in places it might not be as obvious. But I do stress the fact that it doesn't, to love Earth, Wind & Fire or even like the Kendrick Lamar album, which Kamasi Washington wrote those string arrangements, just like, they haunt me like dreams. But that doesn't mean that I love Count Basie or any of the other stuff any less. And personally, I live my life too much like that, where you leave vast parts of yourself aside because people think like you're odd, you know?
Well, I've often wondered if that's kind of an American problem too. I wonder mm-hmm. if we are genre separators and strict about that in ways that maybe people in other countries aren't. At least I have seen that in life. Mm-hmm. It's been my experience that there's a kind of identity defensiveness here, I think, mm-hmm. around what you like somehow represents you. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I can't, you know, if I'm cool, then I can't like Julie Andrews or, you know,
right.
or if I'm
right.
Or if I'm a strict classicist, then I can't like Andy Williams mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. or Diana Ross might be a better example. And I sometimes wonder, especially with younger musicians mm-hmm. or younger mm-hmm. writers, if it isn't, if some of that wall building between genres doesn't have to do with a defensiveness about identity. Like, this is the music I identify with, so therefore I can't like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's a good question. I mean, it's a good way of looking at it. I don't. It's funny you mentioned Andy Williams, and I started thinking about Jimi Hendrix and this interview he did in 1969. And this interviewer said, "What do you do when you're home relaxing?" He says, "Well, you know, like I bake chocolate chip cookies and I listen to Andy Williams." And I could tell the interviewer was waiting for the punchline. And he said, "Andy Williams, that's some real relaxing music." And, you know, here's this guy, this quote, a counterculture icon. And right. I know she's waiting for the guffaw. And he says, you know, he hit that voice like, "Oh, no, I really love Andy Williams." So can you be Jimi Hendrix and love Andy Williams? I mean, maybe that's the great metaphor for this question. And it's yes. And, you know, I think for someone like that, and you've alluded to this talk I gave some time ago, he represented this way of being, well, an artist, but a black man that I'm still looking for models and like role models, I guess. And I saw this guy and I thought, well, okay, he's visceral and all that, but he's soft and he writes these beautiful ballads.
Yeah.
And he talked about loving Philip Jose Farmer. He loved science fiction and Schoenberg. And I thought, so it kind of helped me, like my head peeked out from behind the curtain a little bit more, like, okay, this is all right. And I'm sure in some way what you're talking about in terms of programming is, in maybe a larger sense than I realize, a result of people like, well, again, my parents, but seeing people like Hendrix. And it was in me anyway, because like we used to drink cheap wine in the alley on Friday nights and blah, blah, blah with my friends. And, you know, I would go back in the house and listen to Verdi and cry, you know, and I thought, sometimes I think, Ruben, I don't know, but it's just me. And that's just kind of the simple answer now. It's just me. But it's, you know, it's been a lot for some people that deal with.
So you're kind of like the anti-Wynton Marsalis as far as definitions of what jazz can be.
That's true.
Because he seems like he's got a pretty narrow, with all due respect, he seems like he has a rather narrow vision of what really can be called jazz.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. You know, and it reminds me of, well, I used this analogy earlier, but Thanksgiving dinner and like your uncle's at the table. And I remember this was like, what do you call yourself? Are you black? Are you colored? Are you Negro? Are you African-American? And my uncle, Joe, had specific. He said, "No, I was raised Negro. That's it. That's the way it is." And, I think there are people like that. Whether it's music or, as I said before, if it's poetry, like this really sweet guy had a workshop at the Writers' Center. It's like, "Ruben, I appreciate your interest in all these people, but just letting you know, for me, if it's not rhyme and meter, it's not poetry." And it's like, okay, that's cool. It's Uncle Joe at the dinner table at Thanksgiving. And, you know, at least, you know, you still like the cranberry sauce. So there was some redeeming factor. And it's also just part of the, you know, it's a lane on the highway, you know.
This might be a dangerous question, but I'm curious as to what you think about the notion of song lyrics as poetry. David Layman, including Bob Dylan in his Oxford American Poetry edition, Bob Dylan winning the Nobel Prize for literature. I know in my own household, this was quite divisive.
I remember seeing the Facebook debate here.
I was frankly furious, but I would love to know your take on those kinds of matters.
There are many lyricists whose craft moved and still moves me. And I think they're instructive. They can be instructive. And maybe this is just sort of the poetry nerd side thing. In terms of the way they say what they have to say. And I did this reading recently in Anacostia, and someone asked me a question about a song that's been on your mind lately and what it meant. And it was Rodgers and Hart's "It's Easy to Remember." And I just, you know, your sweet expression, the smile you gave me, the way you looked when we met, it's easy to remember and so hard to forget, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, you know, it's the way it rolls off the tongue, and you can stop it, freeze frame it, and look at the couplets and all. Mm-hmm. But I just think that's a great example of, I don't know how much I'd press down on the accelerator and say, poetry, 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 but it does inform a particular experience, and there is craft involved. So I have no real beefs about this. And one of my favorite writers, not always in terms of content, but I wish I could do internal rhymes like Christopher Wallace or Notorious B.I.G. or Biggie Smalls. I just hear this guy and think, I can't do this. It's just brilliant. It's brilliant as all get out. So yeah, I do think that's another example. Or even little things like, what's that song by Tupac, Dear Mama? It's like, who knew in elementary I would see the penitentiary one day? I'm thinking, elementary penitentiary. There are 8 zillion things I wish I had written, and that's like in my top 5. So I see your point about Dylan and people like that. But I have seen and read and felt these things separate from the music. Mm-hmm. And
I think that's what the question really lies. Can the lyrics stand apart from the music?
In many cases, yes. Yes, yeah.
I think if it had been Smokey Robinson, I wouldn't have had a problem.
Ooh, boy, no. Oh, man. Yeah, that's a whole planet.
He's someone I think of as being able to do things with words I wish I could do.
Oh, the narrative.
I think "I don't like you, but I love you" might be the best statement of John Keats' idea of negative capability that I've ever heard. Mm-hmm. That simple line. Yeah.
And Smokey has that way of just, it's the storytelling. Yes. People say I'm the life of the party because I tell a joke or two, but no.
Yeah.
As Chad Ochocinco used to say, child, please, it's just too much. You know, it's beautiful.
And if that don't do, I'll try something new. Ooh. Another, I think, incredible song yeah. as far as.
Oh, yeah.
And he's someone, too, who has mastered a subject matter. Mm-hmm. I remember him saying, I think, when he won his Kennedy Center honors, mm-hmm. Somebody said, well, you always write love songs. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, love is a subject that never goes out of style.
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, see, you've got all you need right there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Well, thank you so much, Ruben, for talking with me today. We've covered so much ground. And I want to thank Ruben Jackson for being here with me today. He is the archivist of the Felix E. Grant Collection at UDC, former Duke Ellington curator at the Smithsonian. You hear him on the radio on NPR, and you will be in possession of a new book of his next year, forthcoming from Alan Squire Publishing. Title yet to be decided, but it'll be new and selected poems, including the complete text of his award-winning first book, Fingering the Keys. Thank you for talking to me today, Rick.
Well, she's walking through the clouds with a circus mind that's running. Zebras and moonbeams and a fairy tales. That's all she ever thinks of. Riding with the wind. When I'm sad, she comes to me with a thousand smiles.